A Swift Pair of Messengers, Calm with Insight in the Buddha's Words, by Bhikkhu Sujato. Copyright Bhikkhu Sujato, 2012. Read by Justin Merritt. Introduction. Wide open are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears to hear make sure their faith. The Buddha, Majjhima Nikaya 26:21. With this inspired verse, the Buddha declared that the freedom he had realized was available to all. Nothing less than escape from death itself was his promise, and this goal was available to anyone willing to listen to his message with a sincere and confident heart. Many teachers had appeared before him, as they still do today, with such extravagant claims. But the distinctive feature of the Buddha's teaching was a pragmatic course of spiritual training leading step by step to the goal. This work is an attempt to clarify the meaning and function of samatha, tranquility, and vipassana, insight, in Buddhist meditation. Much has been written on this topic, yet a cloud of confusion persists. Though modern Buddhism claims to rest on a foundation of inquiry, many meditators seem willing to invest their spiritual trust in meditation techniques without carefully considering exactly what it is they're practicing. This is not a beginner's introduction nor a guide to the nuts and bolts of practice. It is intended for those who have some knowledge and experience in Buddhist meditation, but who are confused by the diverse and often conflicting opinions expressed by meditation teachers. All of those teachers, however, are unanimous on one point. The greatest teacher, the teacher of teachers, is the Buddha himself. We wish to follow the path of the Buddha, so our starting point should be to see what the Buddha himself said and did not say about meditation. Even though the main aim here is theoretical clarity, I hope to offer inspiration and practical tools for meditation as well. The sutta passages are the heart of this essay. I obviously have my own views on this matter and offer explanations accordingly, but you should accept these only to the extent that they aid your understanding of the suttas. We should never forget the chasm that lies between the label, the word, and the experience to which it points. Even a simple notion, such as Swan River, is so far from capturing the reality of the thing itself, the brackish, lazy smell, the waters filled with jellyfish, or the absence of actual swans. Still worse, the word drags in a welter of others, unseen rivers and unnoticed allusions. And if something so banal is so fraught, what then the hope for agreement in matters such as these, anciently subtle and yet intensely, immediately personal? My only comfort is that the Buddha himself, having briefly flirted with such doubts, decided that words could be good enough. It is the dedicated thirst for understanding, not the complacent acquiescence in an ancient theory, which gives rise to true wisdom. All too often, Buddhists come out trumpeting their commitment to free inquiry over tradition, then content themselves with critiquing any tradition but their own. Really embodying the Dhamma requires a creative engagement with the teachings. In this work, I hardly address the question of how best to apply these teachings in a modern context. While individuals will come to different solutions, I believe that a sincere response will not be easy or comforting. It will not prop up our complacent existence, but will sweep out our stays, precipitating a radical realignment of lifestyle. If we are to understand samadhi, we must first consider how it works within the context of the path as a whole. The most fundamental division of the path is threefold: virtue, samadhi, and understanding. Each of these works to purify and develop the mind in essential ways, working from the coarse to the refined. All Buddhist practice is based on ethical conduct. Virtuous ethical conduct dams the poisonous outflow of defilements which pollute behavior of body and speech, corrupting an individual's relations with the world outside. It conduces to peace and harmony in relationships, in society, and in nature, for a moral person acts in a responsive, cooperative, and non-afflictive manner. The mind established on ethics will lean toward peace, and yet ethics alone is not sufficient to bring true wisdom. For that, we need the specialized development of consciousness through meditation, which the Buddha called samadhi. Samadhi clarifies the still waters, cleansing the subtle afflictions that pollute the mind, cloud the emotions, and darken wisdom. It leads to peace and harmony in the world within, with each mental factor functioning appropriately in balance and unity. And in these still waters, understanding can clear up the source of suffering once and for all. As the Buddha said over and over again in his final days, as the great message he wished to be remembered for, samadhi imbued with virtue is of great fruit and benefit. Understanding imbued with samadhi is of great fruit and benefit. The mind imbued with understanding is completely released from all poisons, that is, the poisons of sensual pleasures, existence, and ignorance. Digha Nikaya 16, 1-12. Meditation is the key to liberating insight. In fact, the exalted mind states of samadhi, when used as a basis for insight, are the very doors to the deathless. What, Bhante Ananda, is one principle declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, Arahant and fully enlightened Buddha, whereby for a monk abiding, diligent, ardent and resolute, the unreleased mind becomes released, the unevaporated poisons become evaporated, and the unattained supreme security from bondage becomes attained? Here, householder, a monk quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unbeneficial qualities, enters and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. The heart's release through loving kindness, the heart's release through compassion, the heart's release through admiration, the heart's release through equanimity. The base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness. In all of these cases, he reflects thus, this attainment of the base of nothingness is formed by volition and acts of will. He understands, whatever is formed by volition and acts of will is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing on that, he attains the evaporation of the poisons, or to the state of non-returning. This, householder, is one principle declared by the Blessed One, whereby the unattained supreme security from bondage becomes attained. When this was said, the householder Dasama of the city Ataka said to the Venerable Ananda, just as if, Bhante Ananda, a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure were to come all at once upon 11 entrances to a hidden treasure, so too, when seeking one door to the deathless, I have all at once come to hear of 11 doors to the deathless. Just as if, Bhante, a man who had a house with 11 doors, and if that house were to burn down, he would be able to save himself through one or other of those doors, so too will I be able to save myself through one or other of the 11 doors to the deathless. Majjhima Nikaya 52. Samatha, or peace of mind, is a gentle and unobtrusive quality. Meek and shy, she sometimes seems unable to hold her own against the forthright boldness of her brother, Vipassana. With his claims to be the central, unique Buddhist meditation, the direct route to ultimate reality. And yet she has a unique contribution to offer, no less precious for being unobvious. Persistent attempts have been made to diminish the significance of Samatha's role in Buddhist meditation in the never-ending search for a shortcut to happiness, so typical of our restless times. We're told that it is difficult in fast-paced modern times to find the tranquility of jhana, which is obviously true, and yet it merely underscores how important serenity is for us here and now. It is precisely because our postmodern world stresses the utility of analytical intelligence so excessively that the complementary, holistic qualities of serenity and joy are sorely needed. Perhaps this essay may make some small contribution toward rehabilitating samatha to her rightful position as the equal partner in that noblest of tasks, the development of the mind. In this work, the path is first examined with a comprehensive survey of core doctrinal categories, emphasizing the role of samatha. The spotlight then turns to conditionality, attempting to pin down the precise nature of the causal connection between key factors. The all-important question, of course, is how to actually walk the path. This is thereby described next, showing the training for both monastics and laity. Given the central importance of samadhi in all the teachings, the question naturally arises as to why it's so useful. How does samadhi work, and what do we get out of it? The highest benefit of samadhi is its support in attaining the various stages of enlightenment, and so the exploration of the path concludes by presenting the noble ones as living embodiments of the path. Lastly, I consider the most important of the sutta passages which have been invoked to cast doubt on the necessity of jhana. Issues relating to the translations have, as far as possible, been reserved for an appendix, so as not to burden the text. A brief selection of comments by some of the most respected contemporary scholars and meditation masters is included. For those who helped me bring this work to light, thank you. Special thanks are due to Venerable Brahmali, who made detailed comments on an earlier draft, some of which have substantially altered the final presentation. For the many faults which doubtless remain, I alone am solely responsible. In this new edition, I have completely revised the text. The first version of this book was written when I was staying in the caves and cliffs of Ipoh, surrounded by high, inaccessible, and forbidding walls of rock. More than a little of this found its way into the prose. I have tried to cut out the text a little, simplifying some of the philosophical matters while expanding the explanations. I have removed some of the more involved discussions on dependent origination, as they were tangential to the main argument. However, the basic structure and scholarship remains identical. In the decades since I first wrote this book, I have not seen any reason to change my basic position. If anything, the importance of samatha seems more obvious to me than ever, and I find myself wondering why we as a meditative tradition are still having this conversation. Things are shifting. The Vipassana rhetoric has toned down, and more teachers are teaching jhanas. Perhaps the time for this book has passed, but as long as major schools of Buddhism continue to claim that jhanas are not necessary for the Buddha's path, I think we still need to listen to what the Buddha had to say on the matter. Chapter 1, A Handful of Leaves. And the Blessed One addressed Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, it might occur to you, in the past we have had the guidance of our teacher. Now we have no teacher, but it should not be regarded thus. The Dhamma and Vinaya I have taught and laid down for you will be your teacher when I have gone." The Buddha, Digha Nikaya 16.6.1. Who should we believe? Amid the shifting sands of opinion, is there a solid rock of certainty on which to stand? The Buddha insisted that personal experience must be the ultimate criterion. But for the unenlightened, personal experience can be ambiguous, even misleading. To complicate matters further, in these times of information overload, there's a bewildering diversity of teachers and teachings, all claiming to be based on experience. In this work, I aim to address not the question of the Kalamas, how do we decide between different religious teachings, but rather, how do we decide between different interpretations of the Buddha's teachings? This question also arose for the Buddha's followers as his life drew to its end. His answer, known as the Four Great References, is recorded as follows. "Hear, monks, a monk may say to you, face to face with the Blessed One, friend, I have heard. Face to face with him, I have received this. This is my Dhamma. This is Vinaya. This is the message of the teacher." Again, monks, a monk may say, "In such and such a dwelling lives a Sangha with an elder, a leader. Face to face with that Sangha have I heard, this is Dhamma, this is Vinaya, this is the message of the teacher." Again, monks, a monk may say, "In such and such a dwelling live many elder monks of much learning who have mastered the tradition, Dhamma experts, Vinaya experts, systematized summary experts. Face to face with them I have heard, this is Dhamma, this is Vinaya. This is the message of the teacher." Again, monks, a monk may say, "In such and such a dwelling lives a monk, an elder of much learning who has mastered the tradition, a Dhamma expert, a Vinaya expert, a systematized summary expert. Face to face with this elder, I have heard, face to face with him, have I received it. This is Dhamma. This is Vinaya. This is the message of the teacher. In all of the above cases, monks, the speech of that monk should neither be delighted in nor disparaged. Every word and phrase should be well apprehended, placed beside the sutta, and compared with the Vinaya. Should they not fit in with the sutta or accord with the Vinaya, you should conclude, certainly this is not the word of the Blessed One, and has been wrongly apprehended by that elder. Thus, monks, you should reject it. If they fit with the sutta and accord with the Vinaya, then you should conclude, certainly this is the word of the Blessed One, and has been rightly apprehended by that elder. Anguttara Nikaya 4.180 and Digha Nikaya 16.4.8. It seems that the Buddha, though aware of the possibility of breakdown in transmission, nevertheless trusted the Sangha to adequately preserve his teachings. The suttas offer the seeker a unique opportunity to engage with a direct expression of perfect enlightenment. Lucid, immediate, and pragmatic, this Dhamma emerged at a time when experiments in democracy could form a model for organization of the Sangha, when freedom of religious creed and practice was unquestioned, and when the religious establishment was straining under the weight of rituals, hierarchies, and mystifications of age-old tradition, unable to address the issues most relevant to people's lives. The spirit of inquiry responded to these conditions with a bewildering diversity of religious sects, of which the Buddha's best stood the test of time. The universal, timeless quality of the Buddha's words, like an arrow aimed straight at the heart of the human condition, inspired an unprecedented effort to preserve his teachings for those who feel. The following passage clarifies both what the Buddha meant by sutta and why this standard is so important. In future times, there will be monks undeveloped in bodily conduct, virtue, mind, and understanding, when suttas spoken by the Tathagata are taught profound, profoundly meaningful, transcendental, dealing with emptiness. They will not listen. They will not lend an ear. They will not set their minds on profound knowledge. They will not think those teachings worth apprehending and mastering. But when suttas composed by literati are taught, literary, with fancy wordings, fancy phrases, irrelevant, spoken by disciples, they will listen. They will lend an ear. They will set their minds on profound knowledge. They will think those teachings worth apprehending and mastering. Thus, monks, from corrupt Dhamma comes corrupt Vinaya. From corrupt Vinaya comes corrupt Dhamma. This is the fourth future danger, as yet unarisen, which will arise in the future. Be alert and strive to abandon it. Anguttara Nikaya 5.79. The texts relied on here are the only ones considered authoritative by all schools of Buddhism. My intention is to establish an interpretation of the crucial features of the path acceptable to all Buddhists by not relying on later authorities peculiar to any particular school. These texts are the five Nikayas of the Pali Sutta Pitaka, excluding later additions to the fifth Nikaya, such as the Patisambhidhamagga, together with the Vinaya Pitaka. There are no doubt some extraneous additions even within this limited body of texts. Yet such additions are mainly limited to supplementary matter such as narrative backgrounds and legends, and do not substantially affect the doctrine. The Vinaya Pitaka as a whole is later than the suttas, but it still contains some early material. However, this is only occasionally relevant for meditation studies. These Nikayas correspond to the Agamas preserved in various Indic languages, as well as the Chinese and Tibetan traditions. A thorough comparative study of the meditation material in all these texts still remains to be done. I have not done such a study, and I do not attempt any but the most perfunctory comparative inquiries in this work. Nevertheless, in the years since writing the first edition of this book, I have studied in some detail the meditation material in different traditions. I have not found any major variations. Such differences as I have noticed tend, if anything, to reinforce the perspective I arrived at in this book. Some of the main results of these comparative studies are included in my book, A History of Mindfulness. I don't want this to become a fundamentalist critique of contemporary schools of meditation, or of the traditional commentaries. It seems that the commentaries in particular have become a favorite target of criticism, particularly for Western scholars. This might be influenced by the generally odious image of institutionalized medieval monasticism in the West, but time and again, initially plausible critiques turn out to be short-sighted, and worse, the critics then proceed to make as many or more new blunders. In fact, the commentaries are an invaluable mine of information on Dhamma, Pali, history, and much else, and any translator owes them a great debt. However, I am resolutely committed to interpreting the suttas on their own terms, and try as I might to see the matter from the commentarial position, I have in several instances reached conflicting conclusions. I have noted some important points of divergence. The points of agreement are too many to mention. I have mentioned such differences not out of a desire to criticize, but because the commentarial system is highly influential in contemporary meditation circles, and therefore has a direct effect on people's lives. I believe that a careful appraisal of the tradition in the light of the suttas will facilitate appreciation of its true value. I have yet to see any satisfactory study along historical and comparative lines of the development of Theravadan thought in these issues. I may simply add that the commentaries universally praise jhana and devote great lengths to explain what it is and how to develop it. However, certain variations in their explanations of key points suggest that the commentaries themselves, as compilations of the opinions of various teachers, contain some divergence of opinion. Thus, purification of mind is defined in the Digha Nikaya commentary as the thoroughly mastered eight attainments, i.e. form and formless jhana, as a basis for vipassana. But in the Visuddhimagga, it is the eight attainments together with access, samadhi. Again, where the Visuddhimagga treats mind as absorption and access samadhi, the Samyutta Nikaya commentary to the same verse defines mind simply as the eight attainments. Again, momentary samadhi occurs only twice, both times subordinate to jhana in the Visuddhimagga, but more often and with more independence in its commentary. These differences could be explained away as mere variations in the letter, but the natural conclusion in the face of the evidence is that there is a divergence in meaning, perhaps a historical development. Far from being a uniform emanation of enlightened wisdom, the commentarial literature is a complex and evolving scholasticism. The tradition itself is quite happy to chronicle unreconciled differences of opinion. In any case, the task I have set myself is to explain what the suttas say, and so I have throughout avoided relying on the commentaries. Nor, with two slight exceptions, have I relied on the testimony of contemporary meditators, as such testimony is diverse and unverifiable. A problem can arise, since even learned scholars can disagree on the meaning of sutta passages. Is the above standard any use? Of course, we can never hope for complete agreement. Any text admits of multiple possible readings. This is all the more so since we are missing so much background and context for the suttas. Nevertheless, two related principles of interpretation can help clarify obscure passages. One we call the principle of proportion. The second, the principle of historical perspective. The principle of proportion. The principle of proportion involves assessing the relative importance and reliability of sutta passages using a variety of acceptable objective criteria. If there are any gray areas, anomalies, or possible conflicts, then the more important and reliable passage should take precedence. It is not necessary to assume that there either are or not contradictions in the sutta texts as we have them, nor that the secondary passages are not authoritative, simply that the primary passages should be granted greater authority. Consider how the suttas were assembled. First, the Buddha would have taught, his followers would memorize the teachings, and later embed them in a framework of time and place. This indicates that it is the doctrinal teachings themselves, rather than background details or anecdotes, which should be accorded greater weight. This can be shown by comparing the following two passages, each introducing the same sutta, the Samanyapahala. The first is from the Vinaya Chulavagga, recounting the history of the recitation of the suttas and Vinaya by the Sangha after the Buddha's passing away. Ananda, where was the Samanyapahala spoken? At Rajagahabante and Jivaka's mango grove. Who with? With Ajatasattu Vedahiputta. Thus, Venerable Mahakasapa asked Venerable Ananda about the settings and the individuals. Using the same method, he asked about the five Nikayas, and Venerable Ananda answered each question. From the Samanyapahala Sutta as recorded in the Digha Nikaya, thus have I heard. At one time, the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha and the mango grove of Jivaka Komanara Bahacha, together with the great Sangha of 1,250 monks. Now at that time, Ajatasattu, the king of Magadha, was seated in the upper veranda of his palace, it being the full moon observance day of the fourth month, the Komudi, surrounded by his ministers. Although the story is essentially the same, the form is different and many details have been added. Even the words, thus have I heard, are missing from the Chulavaga account. From other contexts, it's clear that the phrase, thus have I heard, is reserved for relating events secondhand. If one was actually present, the phrase, face to face have I heard it, is used instead. Thus have I heard, therefore, would not have been spoken by Venerable Ananda, since he was present when many of the suttas were delivered. It must have been inserted by later redactors, specifically to acknowledge the fact that they are passing down material that they did not learn directly from the Buddha. The Buddha described his teachings as the suttas spoken by the Tathagata, and it seems from the above account that his early disciples also regarded the sutta in the most authoritative sense as the doctrinal teachings spoken by the Buddha or his enlightened disciples, as distinct from the incidental details of where it was spoken and to whom, etc. Other common sense considerations should be borne in mind when interpreting the suttas. Minor teachings should concede precedence to central and important themes, especially those given special significance by the Buddha himself. Poetry is naturally less suited to precise and detailed exposition of doctrinal points than prose. In addition, much of the poetry of the Tipitaka seems to be of later date than the prose. When quoting verses, therefore, we will try to restrict ourselves to the earlier strata. Similes, inferences, and passages of dubious or controversial interpretation are likewise of secondary consideration. For several centuries, the suttas were handed down orally, most reciters concentrating on learning texts from a single Nikaya. The arrangers of the suttas would naturally wish to edit their material so that the core teachings would be found in each Nikaya, the fifth minor Nikaya being only somewhat of an exception. In this way, by learning one Nikaya, one should be able to come to an accurate understanding of all the major teachings. The Nikayas differ in perspective and emphasis, but not in doctrine. The interesting conclusion follows that it is unlikely that a text crucial for deciding an important doctrinal point would be found in only one or two Nikayas. The Buddha clearly felt that at least some of his discourses stood in no need of interpretation. These two misrepresent the Tathagata, one who shows a sutta whose meaning requires further explanation as not requiring further explanation, and one who shows a sutta whose meaning does not require further explanation as requiring further explanation. Anguttara Nikaya 2.3. There is therefore no justification for the modern Theravadan assertion that the suttas teach only a provisional, conventional teaching, which the Abhidhamma explains in terms of ultimate reality. Both of these methods are found within the suttas themselves. The suttas are full of similes, parables, and brief or enigmatic teachings which require interpretation. Sometimes the Buddha would do so, or encourage a disciple to do so. Often it is up to the audience, the Buddha apparently recognizing that the process of sincere investigation into meaning can be of more value than being handed all the answers on a plate. But definitive statements of central doctrinal importance belong to those statements that are fully explained. Care should be taken, then, to avoid imputing unjustified meanings to such passages. So what, then, are these central teachings on practice? On the internal evidence of the text themselves, I would suggest that there are three teaching frameworks that should be regarded as primary. The first is a set of seven groups of dhammas, later known as the 37 Wings to Enlightenment, which are taught frequently in the suttas, and which the Buddha, shortly before he passed away, described as the teaching which should be cultivated, developed, and made much of, so that this holy life will last long, for the benefit and happiness of many people, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of deities and humans. Digha Nikaya 16.3.50. The second teaching framework is less well known, but should be seen as central, since it is a practical application of dependent origination. It is said that one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination, and who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. The fundamental significance of causality in the Buddha's teaching is underlined by the famous verse of Venerable Asaji, regarded as the ideal epitome of Dhamma. Whatever phenomena arise from a cause, their cause and their cessation. Such is the doctrine of the Tathagata, the great contemplative. For the teachings where dependent origination is applied to the way of practice, I use the term dependent liberation. Finally, the Buddha said that practice in this Dhamma Vinaya is gradual, with no sudden penetration to knowledge. This gradual training comprises the heart of the second to 12th suttas in the Digha Nikaya and many others. These three teachings, the wings to enlightenment, the dependent liberation, and the gradual training, are discussed in chapters 3, 4, and 5. This, then, is the first principle for interpretation, the principle of proportion, which we are proposing as reasonable guideline to resolve conflicts in doctrinal understanding. Can we really suppose that the Buddha would have left a crucial question underpinning the whole way of practice to a background story, minor category, or dubious inference? Surely it is more reasonable to suppose that he would have described the way of practice very carefully, defined his terms clearly, and repeated them often. This being so, when faced with gray areas or unclear passages, we should interpret the minor statements so as to agree with the major statements, not the other way around. The principle of historical perspective. Our second interpretive guideline is the principle of historical perspective. In the 2,500 years since the Buddha, discussion, systemization, and perhaps modification of the meaning of what he said has continued unabated. It is quite inappropriate to read terminology and concepts of a later era into the texts of an earlier era. This error may occur in a number of ways. New terminology may be invented for old ideas, old words may acquire new meanings, or completely new concepts may be invented and artificially imposed on the older texts. Remember that in the text quoted at the beginning of this paper, the Buddha conferred sole authority on the Sutta and Vinaya. No Abhidhamma and certainly no commentaries. The Abhidhamma did not exist in the Buddha's lifetime, but, along with some later works included in the suttas, was developed during a period of approximately 4 centuries after the Buddha's passing away. The commentaries were not finalized until 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, over the same period when the Mahayana sutras were composed. Some say that even if these texts did not exist in their present form, still their essence was spoken by the Buddha and his disciples. This claim, while not altogether baseless, is misleading. Much of the material in the Abhidhamma and commentaries is perfectly in accord with the suttas and may well be descended from the sayings of the Buddha. However, much of their teachings are radically different in both form and content from the suttas, and it is precisely these passages which give rise to controversy. We can fortunately sidestep the question of whether these teachings differ only in the letter or also in the meaning as a strictly separate and secondary issue. The first of the great references quoted above refers to a teaching that a monk claims to have heard from the Buddha's lips. Even this must only be accepted if it is in line with the suttas and Vinaya. So the suttas can simply be taken on their own terms, and for all important matters, they should be sufficient. To hold that the Buddha was unable to explain what he meant in a central question regarding the path to awakening would be a curious aspersion on his ability. So, what are these later teachings? The Theravada tradition has coined a range of terminology and concepts which, although unknown in the suttas, constitutes the standard vocabulary of contemporary Buddhist meditation teachings. These terms include momentary and access samadhi, vipassana jhana, samatha jhana, and transcendental jhana, the one whose vehicle is serenity, and the one whose vehicle is pure or dry insight. So prevalent is the influence of these terms that the conception of the path of meditation they imply is tacitly accepted by almost all books on meditation, and has been authorized by inclusion in standard reference works. Someone interested in Buddhist meditation can pick up a wide variety of books from diverse sources, simple and complex, all of which reaffirm the same ideas. The plain fact that these special concepts are based on scholastic writings dated centuries after the Buddha and peculiar to the Theravada school is obscured. If we wish to understand the suttas as those who listen to them, we must first carefully examine the contextual significance of crucial terms. Sound textual analysis must proceed from unambiguous contexts as a basis for inferring the meaning of ambiguous contexts. Any interpretation which relies on reading non-standard meanings into ambiguous passages should be rejected out of hand. Samadhi. Samadhi is a regular synonym for one-pointedness of mind, citta-kagata, or unification, ekodibhava. Both samadhi and unification occur in the formula for the second jhana, while elsewhere one-pointedness is also said to already occur in first jhana. The verb forms of unification, which regularly occur alongside samadhiyati, may also refer to first jhana. Here is a standard definition of samadhi from the suttas. One-pointedness of mind, with seven path factors as requisites, is called noble right samadhi, with its vital conditions and requisites. Digha Nikaya 18:27. Right samadhi, or one-pointedness of mind in the context of the path, is the four jhanas. Digha Nikaya 22:21. We shall see below that whenever samadhi is explicitly defined in core doctrinal categories, it is always the four jhanas. This is by far the most important meaning of samadhi in the suttas. Nevertheless, it is possible with a little hunting to find cases which suggest samadhi can have a broader meaning. In a very few contexts, the meaning, not clarified by the context, may be jhana, or possibly mere concentration in the ordinary sense of the word. One passage speaks of a monk establishing the mind one-pointed in samadhi, while in all four postures, including walking. This would seem to be difficult to square with the usual understanding of jhana, although it would not necessarily directly contradict anything in the suttas. Everything else in the sutta, though, is quite standard: virtue, abandoning the hindrances, energy, mindfulness, bodily tranquility, which strikes me as slightly odd in the context of walking, and samadhi, with a verse extolling both samatha and vipassana. Perhaps we might suspect some slightly clumsy editing, and we should not forget the many times when the meditator sits down cross-legged before entering samadhi. More often, samadhi is used to describe meditative states of vipassana or liberation. These include three of the four kinds of development of samadhi: the basis of reviewing, and the signless heart samadhi. These are not substitutes for jhana in any important doctrinal categories. In fact, they regularly follow after jhana. It may be noted that development, bhavana, often refers not to the basic establishing of meditation subject, but to its further advanced development. Presumably, establishing one-pointedness in jhana enables the mind to maintain a comparable level of one-pointedness in the more complex task of vipassana, justifying the term samadhi. Very rarely, samadhi is used as a state of meditation that may precede jhana. The following unique passage describes such a pre-jhanic samadhi. For a monk devoted to the higher mind, there are coarse taints, misconduct of body, speech, and mind. The aware and competent monk abandons, dispels, eradicates, and annihilates them. When they are abandoned, there are middling taints, thoughts of sensual pleasures, ill will, and cruelty. When they are abandoned, there are subtle taints, thoughts of family, country, and reputation. The aware and competent monk abandons, dispels, eradicates, and annihilates them. When they are abandoned and eradicated, from there on there remain only thoughts of Dhamma. Thoughts of Dhamma means just that. The commentary asserts that the phrase refers to the 10 taints of Vipassana, but not only is this an anachronistic reading of a later concept into an earlier text, the context has nothing to do with Vipassana. That samadhi is not quite peaceful, nor refined, nor possessed of tranquility, nor unified, but is actively controlled and constrained. There comes a time when the mind is steadied within, settled, unified, and concentrated in samadhi. That samadhi is peaceful, refined, possessed of tranquility, unified, and is not actively controlled or constrained. One can incline the mind to witness with direct knowledge whatever principle can be witnessed with direct knowledge, and become an eyewitness in every case, there being a suitable basis. Anguttara Nikaya 3:100. It's only when the samadhi is peaceful and refined, in other words, real samadhi, that it leads to the fruits of practice. These higher attainments of the path are regularly said to be the outcome of jhana, so in such contexts it is only reasonable to infer that samadhi here means jhana, as usual. Until the minor hindrances have been fully overcome, and the mind stops thinking, even thinking about the Dhamma, the mind cannot enter jhana and realize the deeper insights. In speaking of the obstacles to meditation, the passage only mentions particular subtle taints, and so it probably deliberately does not quite clarify whether the samadhi accompanied by thoughts about Dhamma is totally free of hindrances or not. There's no mention of sloth or torpor, etc. We might surmise that hindrances, even if not actually arisen, may reemerge at any moment due to the lack of one-pointedness, which is the defining characteristic of true samadhi. The only significance of pre-jhanic samadhi is to precede true samadhi, and hence it's ignored in all expositions of right samadhi. Jhana. According to the Pali Text Society's Pali English Dictionary, jhana never means vaguely meditation. It's the technical term for a special religious experience reached in a certain order of mental states. It was originally divided into four such states. This unambiguous meaning occurs many hundreds of times. If one searches among the thousands of early Buddhist texts, it is possible to find a few different usages. Very rarely, for example, jhana may refer to a non-Buddhist form of self-torment, such as the breathless jhana. Majjhima Nikaya 36:21. In prefixed form, jhana often means ponder or brood. Occasionally, the simple and prefixed forms are used together in a disparaging sense. Despite the obvious incongruity, I retain the word jhana in the following passages for the sake of consistency. Then, when Maradusi had possessed the Brahmin householders, they abused, reviled, mocked, and harassed the virtuous monks of good character thus: "These baldies, monkeys, menial darkies, spawned from the ancestors' feet, claim, we're doing jhana, we're doing jhana. And with shoulders drooping, heads hanging, and all limp, they do jhana, redo jhana, outdo jhana, and misdo jhana. Just like an owl on a branch watching out for a mouse, like a jackal on a riverbank watching out for a fish, like a cat by a doorpost or a dustbin or a drain watching out for a mouse, like a clapped-out donkey hanging around a doorpost or a dustbin or a drain does jhana, re-does jhana, out-does jhana, and mis-does jhana." Majjhima Nikaya 50:13. It hardly needs to be said that this kind of jhana is not what the Buddha was encouraging his followers to practice. Nevertheless, this passage provides a clue as to the basic non-specialized meaning of jhana: close, sustained, concentrated observation at a single point. The significant image of food as the object of jhana recurs in the following remarkable passage, which encompasses the broadest range of meanings of jhana. "Santa, you should practice the jhana of the thoroughbred steed, not the jhana of the clumsy nag. What is the jhana of the clumsy nag? The clumsy nag, Santa, when tied up by the feeding trough, does jhana thus: fodder, fodder. For what reason? It does not occur to him, what task will the trainer set for me today? What can I do for him in return? Tied up by the feed trough, he just does jhana thus, fodder, fodder. In just the same way, a certain clumsy nag of a person who has gone to a forest, the root of a tree, or an empty place, abides with heart obsessed and overwhelmed with sensual lust, ill will, sloth and torpor, restless and remorse, and doubt. He does not understand the escape from these things in accordance with reality. Having formed these things inside himself, he does jhana, re-does jhana, out-does jhana, and mis-does jhana. He does jhana dependent on earth, water, fire, air, the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, this world, the world beyond, on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought out, and explored by the mind. This is the jhana of the clumsy nag of a person. What is the jhana of the thoroughbred steed? The excellent thoroughbred steed, when tied up by the feed trough, does not do jhana thus, fodder, fodder. For what reason? It occurs to him, what task will the trainer set for me today? What can I do for him in return? The excellent thoroughbred steed regards the application of the whip as a debt, imprisonment, loss, and misfortune. In just the same way, the excellent thoroughbred steed of a person does not abide with the heart obsessed with the five hindrances. He does not do jhana dependent on earth, on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought out, and explored by the mind. And yet, he does practice jhana. Anguttara Nikaya 11.10. This passage brings out a number of points in the usage of the term jhana. The similes differentiate between the mind focused on one thing and the mind engaged in reflective consideration. The former is called jhana, the latter not. The series of four derivatives of jhana augmented with prefixes is always used in connection with the five hindrances, never with the four jhanas. The mention of the four elements seems to be an idiomatic reference to the four form jhanas. To preserve consistency, the text applies jhana to the formless attainments, a common usage in later literature, but perhaps unique in the suttas. The jhana mentioned in the final phrase may be the fruition, attainment of arahatship. Notice this meditative experience of enlightenment is distinguished from the form and formless jhanas. Although the text does not unequivocally praise jhana, it is not the jhana, but the person practicing it whom the Buddha criticizes, and then only by comparison with the arahant. As we shall see below, the ideas of food and dependence imply dependent origination. So all conditioned states are being faulted here from the standpoint of ultimate wisdom as being still bound up with rebirth. It should be re-emphasized that these broad usages of the term jhana, here mentioned for completeness, are exceedingly rare. These are the only meanings of the word jhana and samadhi which can unambiguously be established from the early suttas. Since these two words often occur with such clear meaning, it seems reasonable to assume that they refer to the four jhanas unless there is contextual evidence otherwise. As samadhi may have a broader meaning on occasion, however, we will try to confirm the contextual meaning whenever possible. Vipassana jhana. The controversial term vipassana jhana seems to stem from a historical development in the application of the terms samatha and vipassana. In the suttas, no meditation technique is labeled, such as by saying kasinas and loving-kindness are samatha, satipatthana is vipassana. A growing tendency to segregate and systematize the various meditation subjects developed into the prevailing practice of identifying samatha and vipassana with the meditation subjects themselves, rather than with the mental qualities which the techniques foster. Having thus labeled a certain technique as vipassana, it was found that experiences of rapture, serenity, and bliss occurred during vipassana. These experiences were then called vipassana jhana. But these emotional qualities are precisely what samatha refers to. This is not some new kind of jhana happening in vipassana. It's just samatha, pure and simple. It simply happens to occur while practicing a meditation technique whose primary purpose is to develop vipassana. One may hear that vipassana helps to relieve stress, solve psychological imbalances, or increase compassion, but these things are aspects of samatha, development of the mind, regardless of the label stuck on the technique. As long as the mind is still moving, however, and as long as the five external senses still impinge, it falls short of true jhana, the mind absolutely content to rest still within itself. Transcendental jhana. There is one further concept to be discussed, transcendental jhana, Lokuttara jhana, which has been pressed into service as a substitute for samatha jhana to fulfill the path factor of right samadhi. This idea is based on the Pratisambhidamagga, one of the latest books in the Suttapitaka, as well as the canonical Abhidhamma texts. It was taken up and developed by the commentators using their own special concepts. According to the developed commentarial theory, transcendental jhana is a special kind of jhana which occurs only at the time of penetrating to the noble paths and fruitions. This samadhi can apparently occur with the same mental factors as any of the four jhanas, but is distinguished by taking nibbana as its object and by permanently eradicating, rather than merely suppressing, the defilements appropriate to each path. The four paths are each as conceived as lasting one mind moment, another commentarial concept, occurring once only, while the fruition can be re-entered by the noble ones after appropriate preparation. This mind moment is supposed to last less than a billionth of the duration of a flash of lightning. With the possible exception of fruition attainment, none of these ideas find support in the suttas. Supporters of this theory will usually point to the Mahachaturisaka Sutta, which distinguishes between the transcendental and non-transcendental path for the first five path factors. However, the text does not maintain that distinction for the factors of the samadhi aggregate. Majjhima Nikaya 117. The divergence in presentation is not arbitrary. The express purpose of the sutta is to show how all the path factors function to support samadhi for one developing the noble path. The first five factors are accordingly given special definitions appropriate in the context of samadhi. In particular, right view and right intention are defined by way of cognitive function rather than objective content. But the final three factors in their normal formulation already pertain directly to samadhi, so stand in no need of any special definition here. In any case, the mere mention of the words noble, poison-free, transcendental, a factor of the path, even if they were applied to jhana, would hardly imply the details of the commentarial theory. See Digha Nikaya 28:18. The definition of the spiritual faculty of samadhi is also relied on to support this thesis. In the section dealing with the spiritual faculties, I offer an alternative interpretation, reserving a technical critique of the commentarial position to Appendix A. On these insubstantial grounds rests the entire elaborate edifice of the commentarial theory. One may wonder why the Buddha, normally so precise in wording, would choose to use such terms as path and person to describe a mind moment. Such ideas may have evolved from the recorded instances of apparently sudden penetration to the Dhamma. It seems that the path is entered at one time, developed gradually, and matures into the fruition at another time after a short or long interval. This is explained with such similes as chicks breaking out of their shells after incubation, or the collapse of a ship's rigging after rotting away for a long time in the weather. Samyutta Nikaya 22:101. The commentarial position that the path happens in a flashing moment and that therefore all passages that refer to the path in its technical sense refer to that moment only is a curious idea indeed, and one that finds no support in the suttas. On the contrary, the suttas constantly speak of one on the path as a person who develops the path over a period of time. Key sutta passages on the path are collected below. Just as, monks, this great ocean deepens gradually, inclines gradually, slopes gradually, with no abrupt precipice, Even so, in this Dhammavinaya, there is gradual training, gradual work, gradual practice, with no abrupt penetration to profound knowledge. Just as the great ocean is the home of many great beings, so too this Dhammavinaya is the home of many great beings. The stream enterer, the one on the way to witnessing the fruit of stream entry, and so on. Anguttara Nikaya 4.200. As he develops samatha prior to vipassana, the path is born in him. He cultivates, develops, and makes much of that path. Anguttara Nikaya 4.170. One who, regarding the well-taught word of Dhamma, lives on the path, restrained and mindful, cultivating blameless states, this is the third kind of monk, the liver of the path. The four pairs of people, the eight individuals, these are the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential greeting, an unexcelled field of merit in the world. Digha Nikaya 16.2.9. These eight people who are praised, the four pairs of the Blessed One's disciples, they are worthy of offerings. What is given to them bears great fruit. An offering to one on the way to witnessing the fruit of stream entry can be expected to repay incalculably. What could I say of an offering to a stream enterer? Majjhima Nikaya 142.6. The Dhamma follower and faith follower are those who are on the way to stream entry. For the commentaries, they are merely a mind moment, yet the suttas constantly treat them as a person in the ordinary sense. He is incapable of doing any action, having done which he would be reborn in hell, the womb of an animal, or the ghost realm. He is incapable of passing away without witnessing the fruit of stream entry. Samyutta Nikaya 25. Just as that tender calf, just born, being urged on by its mother's lowing, also breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the further shore, so too those monks who are Dhamma followers, faith followers, by breasting Mara's stream, they too will get safely across to the further shore. Majjhima Nikaya 34.10. So what do you think, Badali? Suppose there was a monk who was a Dhamma follower, a faith follower, and I told him, come, monk, be a plank for me to walk across the mud. Would he walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise, or would he say no? No, Bhante. Majjhima Nikaya 65.11. When that venerable one makes use of suitable dwellings, associates with good friends, and composes his spiritual faculties, he may witness the supreme goal. He still has work to do with diligence. Majjhima Nikaya 70.21. In the following sutta passage, one of the chief lay disciples relates how he learns of the monk's attainments. It's no surprise, Bhante, when the Sangha is invited by me, that deities approach me and tell me, that monk, householder, is one released on both sides. That one is released by understanding. That one is a personal witness. That one has attained to view. That one is faith released. That one is a Dhamma follower. That one is a faith follower. That one is virtuous of good qualities. That one is immoral of evil qualities. Anguttara Nikaya 8.22. Seeing some wanderers of other sects walk by, King Pasenadi asks the Buddha, Bhante, are those among those in the world who are arahants or attain to the path of arahantship? We might note here that the word path, magga, is rarely used in the suttas to denote those developing the path. The synonym way, patipada, defined just as the Noble Eightfold Path, Samyutta Nikaya 45.31, is the usual term. Nor is the path normally divided into four as such. The path is just the Noble Eightfold Path. But those at different stages practice for different immediate goals. This being so, the phrase, the path to arahantship, simply refers to the Eightfold Path. It is hard, great king, for you as a layperson enjoying sensual pleasures, dwelling crowded by children, using sandalwood imported from Benares, wearing garlands, perfume, and makeup, and accepting golden money, to know whether these are arahants or those attained to the path of arahantship. Samyutta Nikaya 3.11. Or similarly, in speaking of what kinds of monks would attend an animal sacrifice, the Buddha said, "Neither arahants nor those attained to the path of arahantship will attend such a sacrifice." Why not? Because beatings and throttlings of sacrificial animals are seen there. But arahants or those attained to the path of arahantship will attend the kind of sacrifice where regular family gifts are specially given to virtuous monks. Digha Nikaya 5.23. Those of us who cannot imagine a mind moment lying in the mud or attending a meal or accepting a gift will conclude that the commentarial instant path theory cannot be relied on to explain these suttas. The mind moment theory of the path does not merely conflict with a few minor passages. It is at odds with the very nature of samadhi as taught in the suttas. The suttas regularly speak of samadhi as a gradual settling of activities, resulting in a stable coalescence of mind that lasts for a substantial period of time, into which one enters and abides. The word abides, viharati, is specifically and exclusively used in Pali to denote an ongoing situation or event. A typical example. "And so, Anuruddha, abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute, I perceive limited light and saw limited forms. I perceived measureless light and saw measureless forms even for a whole night, a whole day, a whole night and day." Majjhima Nikaya 128-29. This, then, is our second principle of interpretation, that of historical perspective. This principle guards against playing Chinese whispers with the Dhamma, relying on an interpretation of a retelling, of an exposition, of a summary of something the Buddha was supposed to have said. The original teachings are available to us. Great as our gratitude is to the monks who preserved and passed down the suttas, do we really suppose that any of them could explain Dhamma better than the Buddha himself? The idea that commentarial or Abhidhamma concepts are needed to correctly interpret the suttas hardly accords with the Buddha's own description of his liberating teaching. "Perfect in every aspect, fulfilled in every aspect with neither lack nor excess, well explained and entirely complete." Digha Nikaya 29.16. In claiming that his teaching was complete, the Buddha, of course, did not pretend that he had answered all the questions and given all facts. He did claim, however, to set out with sufficient detail, clarity, and precision a framework for understanding adequate to serve as guide for all essential questions of practice and theory. This is illustrated with the famous simile of the handful of leaves. Then the Blessed One, taking a few simpasa leaves in his hand, addressed the monks. "What do you think, monks? Which is greater, the few leaves in my hand or those left up in the trees?" "The few leaves taken up by the Blessed One in his hand are less, Bhante. Those left up in the trees are certainly greater." "Just so, monks, the things I have directly known but I have not declared to you are certainly greater. What I have declared is less. And why are they undeclared by me? They're pointless, not pertaining to the fundamentals of the holy life, not leading to repulsion, fading away, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nibbana. Therefore, they are undeclared by me. And what is declared by me? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. And why is that declared by me? Because it has a point. It is pertaining to the fundamentals of the holy life, leading to repulsion, fading away, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, nibbana. Therefore, it is declared by me." Samyutta Nikaya 56.31.